To us, folks. Unfortunately, you're not able to watch us live on Facebook this morning. We've had some technical difficulties with that, but you can listen to us at WMNF.org, and you can listen to us on 88.5 FM in your car.
That's right.
Okay, or on your phone.
That's right.
All right. So listen, we'll be right back with our guest, Attorney Geraldine Williams. We'll be back.
On WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for the National Public Radio, and we'll be right back.
From NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Washington state officials cautiously optimistic about the growing numbers of their employees getting the COVID vaccine as a deadline looms. NPR's Martin Karste has more from Seattle.
Washington has one of the country's toughest mandates for state employees. Show proof that you're fully vaccinated by October 18th or lose your job. There were some early worries of widespread noncompliance in departments such as corrections and the state patrol, but those entities are now reporting vaccination rates approaching or exceeding 90%. The state's ferry system, which has been plagued by crew shortages and reports of anti-vaccine sickouts, is also approaching 90%, according to spokesman Ian Sterling.
I'm hopeful that most people decide to stay with the organization. We certainly need good, solid mariners, and they'll continue to make the boats go back and forth.
Some state employees will get a grace period if they asked for an exemption and are still waiting for a decision. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
Back in Washington, immigrant rights activists are pushing key Democrats not to give up on a pathway to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants. NPR's Joel Rose reports they're urging lawmakers to ignore unfavorable rulings from the Senate parliamentarian.
Protesters gathered outside the Brooklyn home of Senator Chuck Schumer last week for a sleepout, pressuring the Senate Majority Leader to keep pushing for a pathway to citizenship for essential workers and other undocumented immigrants.
We are risking our lives. We have no permanency. We want citizenship now.
Immigrants and advocates have also protested in recent days at the White House and at appearances by Vice President Kamala Harris in New Jersey. They want Democrats to reject the Senate parliamentarian's opinion. The chamber's nonpartisan rulekeeper has decided twice that sweeping immigration proposals should not be included in the budget reconciliation process. But Senate Democrats say those rulings leave them with limited options. Joel Rose, NPR News.
Polls are scheduled to close in a couple of hours in Iraq, where voters are electing a new parliament. The election is the sixth since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, and it's being held early following violent protests in 2019. Researchers say, on average, countries across the world have only 75% of their biodiversity left, a level of environmental depletion that may leave them unable to provide adequate energy, food, and resources in the future to meet the needs of their people. Professor Andy Purvis led the research and spoke with the BBC.
People often think that biodiversity is nice to have, almost a luxury that's beautiful to look at, but we don't depend on. That's really wrong. It's actually the foundation of our society. If we start to take more from nature than it can provide sustainably, we risk huge disruption to our very way of life.
Professor Purvis speaking there with the BBC, and you're listening to NPR News. Drought and extreme summer heat have severely damaged crops in the Northwest, and now that it's fall, farmers are beginning to tally the wreckage. From the Northwest News Network, Anna King reports.
Walla Walla sweet onions turned to mush, tomatoes grew with no blossoms to make red orbs, and the potatoes? This summer's extreme heat has meant spuds are coming out of the ground in weird shapes, making it hard to cut fries. And yields are down about 25% on a crop that usually has a 1% swing. The drought even means there's less western hay for purchase to carry cattle over the winter, and it's affecting next year's crops. Wheat farmers say this is one of the driest falls they've ever seen, making it difficult to plant. For NPR News, I'm Anna King in Pasco, Washington.
Authorities in Georgia still looking for a suspect who fatally shot a 26-year-old police officer who'd been working his first shift with the department. But manhunts in Louisiana and Arizona have come to an end. The suspect, caught in Arizona, is accused of critically injuring a sheriff's deputy in Louisiana. Officials say a man arrested last night is accused of going on a shooting spree that left two people dead, including a state trooper. Pope Francis met today with a Colombian nun who's been freed after being kidnapped by Islamist militants in Mali more than 4 years ago. In a statement today, the Vatican said Francis met with Sister Gloria Narvaez in St. Peter's Basilica just before celebrating Mass. Mali announced her release yesterday. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.
WMNF wants to hear from local artists like you. If you're a poor around Tampa Bay, go to our website at WMNF.org. From there, click on Poets of the Month under the Programming tab. If you're selected, your poem will be broadcasted on our airwaves. Be one of WMNF's first Poets of the Month by going to WMNF.org. WMNF is accepting volunteer applications to be part of our on-air team.
And welcome. This is Latinx.
Welcome to the Soul Kitchen. It is I, your resident chef, Big Eddie G.
Join your favorite voices on 88.5 FM, WMNF.org, and our HD channels. If you've always dreamed of being on the radio,
I would love to be on the radio.
Now's your chance.
Join your listening supported radio station, WMNF.
Apply under the programming tab at WMNF.org.
This is Truth Radio, 88.5 WMNF.
And you are listening to the Sunday Forum, Walter L. Smith in the Fourth Estate. And we're looking for your telephone calls as we talk to Attorney Geraldine Williams about family biography, autobiography. So keep it tuned and call us up, 813-239-9663. Here's Walter L. Smith.
All right. Welcome back to the Sunday Forum here on WMNF 88.5 Tampa. It's now 7 minutes. 7 minutes after the hour of 9:07. How many ways can we say that?
9:07.
Oh, man. Listen.
7 minutes after the hour.
That's it. Seven minutes after the hour. 9:00. Here on WMNF this Sunday, this beautiful Sunday morning.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
You know, we was out at the Hillsborough County State Park yesterday for a few minutes, and that was a great experience.
Was it?
Yes, it was.
Did it rain?
Not while we were there. I think I left a couple of people there, so it made it rain on them. Sorry.
You're so loyal. Folks, we are glad to have you here with us this morning. Our guest this morning is none other than Attorney Geraldine Williams. My mom here on the Sunday Forum as we talk about this literary series that she has put together that is just astounding so many people who are listening and people who have read it and come in contact with it as she tells a story of our family matrilinearly. Mm-hmm. That is a very, very interesting story. I sat there and listened to my mom daily pick up the phone and call me like, guess what? It made me very happy to know that my mother was happy. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that she was doing some work that made her happy.
Right. And it was a historic time when we left for the break. She was telling us about open elections in South Africa at the time that Mandela became president.
Yes.
Nelson Mandela.
That's something to know that the descendant of that little African girl
Yeah.
Right? Has done this.
Or in the company of such a historic figure.
Right. And not even in the company of that historic figure so much as helping to bring about a change in a way that would transform in some way, in the best way we could possibly do.
And who knows, her work may have got a lot of people politically woke here in this country. That was the first time I remember seeing the black fist raised when Mandela toured this country, which means a lot of people woke up.
Oh, yeah.
In the process.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But she's people, on the phone, so we're talking about her like she's not even here.
I know. Mom?
Yes?
Hey. So we are very excited. I mean, we talk about movements. You and I have spoken about movements and why you were not a part of the Black Power movement. And you said because Granddaddy told you no. It was the only time he told you no, right?
The only time.
And I remember you telling me a story, and I think it's very relevant to what we're talking about today, even though it was in the second part two. You see, all this stuff is connected, man. You're right.
Mm-hmm. It's part of a connected momentum.
Yeah, yeah. So in part two, you bring up a situation that took place when you were graduated from college and you were working at a newspaper in St. Pete. Tell us about what happened.
Oh, okay. I think I told you I didn't tell many others, but I was really astounded when Anita Hill did what she did in terms of revealing a relationship with the candidate, the African-American candidate for U.S. Supreme Court, and Thomas. And she was saying how she had been, quote unquote, a victim of his approaches to her. And I was astounded because when I was a very young woman on my first job as a reporter, there were lines of tables where the reporters sat with their typewriters. We didn't have computers then, typewriters. And I was going through one of those lines. So there was a row of typewriters in front and a row behind me, and I'm walking through to get to my seat. And one of the white reporters decided that it was okay for him to touch me on my behind.
Uh-uh. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm 21 years old. And I had not been a problem at all. I didn't even have to apply for the position because I had won the Hearst Award. I mean, this is St. Pete Times, and they said, no, you come to us. And I said, that's okay with me. Fine. Thank you. And when he did that, and you cannot imagine because you people are so young, The typewriters made a lot of noise, and the press information from UPI, United Press International, and AP, Associated Press, all just a lot of noise. And I stopped right there, and I turned to him, and I spoke, and I was captain of the cheerleaders, so I have some volume, okay? I used that volume to let him know that he could not do that, and that my mother and my father had not raised me to be just available for a white man. I mean, I really went off. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it shocked everybody, and so in the back, there were these glass windows that the editors could look through. They sat behind the glass windows, and everybody just stopped. Everything stopped, and everybody stopped. And I just let it be known that it could not happen. I didn't want it to happen again. I wouldn't accept it, and that was just going to be it. I mean, I just went on and on. So the head editor, as a black male reporter, to please escort me out of the newsroom and take me over to the hotel and sit at the bar and just let me kind of calm down, maybe have a glass of wine or something.
Yeah.
So we stayed for several hours over there. When I went back, they had moved him from where he was seated and placed him against the wall on the other side. I never had any problems with him after that. Now, we had been friendly because I had been friendly with all of the reports. And he was an absolute, now I don't typically find white men to be attractive, but he was an absolutely good-looking white man. I think he was maybe Italian or, you know, from down in the southern part of the world. Oh, my gosh, he was I didn't care. I mean,
you had a good tan.
No, it won't go that way. But I knew too much to be able to accept. And see, he could probably have done that with a white woman, and it would have been okay because the man was so good looking. I did not care, but I dealt with mine right then, not 20 years later. I couldn't wait that.
Yeah, she had a Me Too moment back then, and she spoke out.
Pioneers of the Me Too moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I didn't have any problems. After that, everything went well. But
I gotta say this, Ma. When she told me that story, I'm thinking to myself, Lord Jesus, take the wheel. He did what?
This is about to crash out of control.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it wasn't a pretty situation. Not at all. Wow. I didn't have any problems when I was in school at the University of Florida. None of the teachers, none of the white boys, none. And then I went there and had that situation. No, you're reading me wrong.
Right.
Listen, we got a call. We have a call on the line. Let's get this call. Caller, welcome to the Sunday Forum.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, brother, what's going on?
It's all good, man. I just want to say I really appreciate this program. It's just wonderful listening to Attorney Williams tell this story. And I just I would be remiss if I did not give a shout out to the last revolutionary standing, Chairman O'Malley Yesitala, the leader of the International African Revolution. He just turned 80 yesterday. And
oh, wow.
Announced that to the world and offered him and his wife, Deputy Chair Ona Zene Yesitala, also turned, I don't know how old she turned, yesterday, but she had a birthday yesterday as well. And so I just wanted to offer a tremendous revolutionary happy birthdays and shout outs to him publicly so that people can, go to APS, APSP, Uhuru.org and give shout outs if they will, some kind of way connect with the movement because the chairman has been standing in the paint. You know, I listened to your mother. She talked about how African men were broken, how white men did things that broke African men. And Chairman is one of those Africans who remained unbroken and has for the past almost 50 years since the inception of the African People's Socialist Party in 1972. He's a tremendous African and deserves our celebration. And so, last thing, I want to say happy first anniversary to Dr. Faith Felder. She's celebrating her 1-year wedding anniversary. Anniversary today.
Yeah, happy anniversary, brother.
Thank you, man. I just want to give her that shout out, too. So, hey, I appreciate you, as always, allowing me to share on your program, and I look forward to the next time we can shake hands.
Oh, man, always glad to have you, brother. Always glad to have you, man. Again, congratulations, brother. Attorney Life Malcolm.
Yeah,
right, my on, man.
100%.
My man.
That makes us so proud, man.
All right, man. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
That was all right.
It would be good to talk to O'Malley. I'm sure he has a lot to tell.
Yeah, we got to bring him on. When I was brought on the first time, when Otis brought me on here and Shanghai, me and the host of the show.
Yeah. I remember.
He was in the studio.
Yep.
And I've had some great conversations with him one-on-one.
Great 80 years old. And he doesn't look a day over 50.
Looks great. Looks absolutely great.
I guess that having that gym helps.
I guess so.
I'm going to get a gym. So. I'm going to go to the gym over there.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Hey, Mom.
What?
So we look at the moment. For those of you who missed it, I can honestly say that my mother was one of the pioneers of the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
That is actually a very telling situation. as I look forward to the what happened in Africa, and you as a woman in Africa, on the continent of Africa, in South Africa of all places, were able to make some really interesting strides and to navigate that country during the time of apartheid, then during transition, and then after apartheid, so to speak, post-apartheid.
Walter, let me quickly take that because it's a lot that happened in South Africa, but I want to go on the road to Mandela. And I want to say quickly that on the road to Mandela, I met other people who were very influential in my movement. Now, I didn't go to meet Mandela. I was hoping to meet Winnie, but there is no way I could ever have expected to meet President Mandela. So I didn't even look forward to it. And before the election, my group was teasing me because the Zulus were not going to be a part of the election because they had not included their chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi on the voting ballot. And they had not guaranteed the retention of the Zulu kingdom. And so Buthelezi was saying no. And that was tense, okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was so tense that I didn't get any sleep because I was scared of the Zulus. Now, this is in 1994. I had carried Walter, my son Walter, to South Africa as part of his high school graduation gift. We had gone to Asia, we had gone to Alaska, we had gone down to the Bahamas, and I said, come on, let's go to South Africa. So we went to South Africa, and we got permission, finally, it was a while now, for us to get permission to travel to the Zulu battlegrounds, because I claimed to be Zulu. And we went to all the, and I actually have pictures of having gone to these battlegrounds, and one set of pictures is of this guy who was protecting the area, showing where they had lived, the Kraals, K-R-A-A-L, where they had lived, where the Zulus had lived. And I showed so much interest that he went, and from the digs, he gave me some royal Zulu beads. So I have that.
Okay,
we went on, and we went over to Ulundi, U-L-U-N-D-I, and that is that's the headquarters for the
KwaZulu-Natal.
It's now KwaZulu-Natal, but that it's Ulundi. So we went into Ulundi, and I said, okay, I had gone through everything. I've gone through, and I've taken pictures. I'm tired. I was very, very sick. As a matter of fact, they had to go out and find a doctor to bring the doctor to the hotel, which is the smallest Holiday Inn in the world. And there was no one else there but our family. So they went out and they found this a doctor who came in, and he gave me a portion to replenish my electrolytes. I was totally depleted. And this is high altitude. When I came back to the States, I found out that I have a sickle cell trait. So that's what was happening there at high altitude. And I'm moving around and all of that. But anyway, I decided, okay, we're going to leave here now. I've done my little Zulu thing, ancestral thing. We're going to go to the bright lights over on the Indian Ocean and, you know, the fine hotels and the music and all of it because it's Christmas. And when I was standing at the desk to leave my key, I had my head down and I looked and I saw these two pairs of shoes, highly, highly polished shoes. And I'm saying, there's nobody here. Who are these people? So I looked up and I saw these two ebony men, beautiful men, and I said, well, who are you? And they chuckled because they could tell my accent that I was American, and they said that they were chief security for Mangosuthu Buthelezi. And I said, well, if you're chief security, why are you here and I don't see him? And they said that he was with the royal family and that they were worshiping at church. This is on Christmas morning in 1994. So I said, Oh, and I said, Zungum Zulu. I know I didn't have the accent right, but he understood. I was saying, I am Zulu. And he said, oh, madame, I believe that the chief would want you to join the royal family. And I said, and you can bet that I would want to join the royal family. So my destination changed. I went back to the hotel room and changed clothes. And so Walker said, now we are going to dine with the Zulu royal family. So when the chief came, he spoke with me, and I told him, Zungum Zulu. I'm feeling good. I knew how to say it. And he chuckled and he said, madam, you are American, right? I said, yes, I am. He said, well, you couldn't be Zulu. And I listened, and I had to be very careful because he was very powerful. And so I said, why shouldn't I be Zulu? He said, because we're so far south. And the Africans who were taken away to America left from West Africa, Northwest Africa. And I said, Chief, I agree with you. Now, he didn't know I had been to Zimbabwe, and I had studied there for about 2 weeks. And I knew something about the history of the area. And one of the things I learned is that he's supposed to be a descendant of Xhosa Zulu. And I said, now, I'm not going to offend this man at all. But I said, you know, there was some of his aunties who were leaving Xhosa, and one went south, and that was Miss Braceway, who went over those high mountains and established Kingdom of Lesotho, okay? But others went north and went across the Limpopo River and went over, they became migratory. They were just moving, moving. And I said, so, I talked about
Zulukazi
and a Lobengula. And so, you know, he stood back and he listened. And then I talked about how they moved from there and they went, some went north, further north. I said, so now, while the Anglos took Africans from Northwest Africa, they were not all from there. Some came from the south, some came from the east. You know, I had done my research too. So he said, indeed, madam, you could be Zulu. Well, then that meant that I could have my family to have dinner with the Zulu family. And that was, I mean, unbelievable. They made me cry. Now, when we sing the Black National Anthem, that's one thing. But let me tell you, when those Zulus sing that Inkosi Sikelane, God Bless Africa, I mean, it felt like the room was playing and they were singing a cappella. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Well, anyway, that was very important for me to have met Buglazi because while I actually was living in South Africa, after I went back to live, Buglazi had to get me released from, I had been detained, okay? Came back into the country from Lesotho. I had visited Ambassador Bismarck Myers, and when I came back, I had this big, bag, ostrich skin bag, which is, you know, it says you got some money. They told me that my paperwork was not proper and that I could not go through. And I said, so what you going to do with me? And I said, you going to send me back? What do you mean? It's not. It was proper for me two or three days ago when I left to go to Lesotho. And so they said I could pay them and I could go through. And I said, now, how does paying you correct anything? And I just grabbed. It's fraud. I'm not going to pay you. So I wouldn't. And so I said, I don't have any money. And he looked at my handbag like, lady, I mean, try something else. I said, I'm not paying you. So I didn't. And so they detained me. So they took me upstairs. And when I got up there, I said, does this mean that I am arrested? And they said, well, madam, you are detained. And I said, so that means then that I have, listen, the American legal introduction. I said, I have a telephone call to make, and I want to make my telephone call. And he said, okay, madam, whom do you want to call? And I said, I want to call Chief Megasutu Buthelezi. Now, let me tell you why that was important. He was working at the airport. And after during the election, Buthelezi got the portfolio for being head of the Home Affairs. So he was in charge of all everybody who came in and everybody who came out. Through the airport, through the buses, through the car, he was in charge of all the borders. And so that was, he was this man's boss. And when I said that, he said, madam, what did you say? And I told him again. And I said, so give me the phone. Let me make my call. And I called. And I actually talked with the chief. But see, he remembered me from having been with, having had Christmas 1994 dinner with the Zulu royal family. Well, after I talked with Buthelezi, I was moved from the chair I was sitting in to a beautifully upholstered chair. I was given a hot tea, and I was given coffee. And so they came over with a whole different attitude, and they wanted to know, how did I happen to know the chief? And I said, that's for me to know and you to find out. I'm not telling you anything. And I did. But I did get relief, and I was pleased that chief helped me out in that regard. But my my other members of the NGO were teasing me and said, Jerry, why are you so afraid? If you're Zulu, why are you afraid of the Zulus? You know, because I'm saying they're going to attack us, and it doesn't make any sense to me that this would be happening. Why can't we just put the man's picture on, and those who want to vote for him can vote for him, and those who want to vote for the others can vote for them? And so they wanted to know about my relationship with Buthelezi. And I told them about what we had done, and they did go back, and my group recommended that they include the Zulus in the process and put Buthelezi's picture. Now, I have the ballot where he was not on the ballot, but then they changed it and added his name, so I felt a whole lot better. And so I just wanted to let you know that on the way to meeting Mandela, I was also in a minority in that. I only knew the Afrikaners. And I knew them because when I went for the election, as I told you, NGO was exposed to all of these very, very high-end people who were in charge of everything in the country. And I took their cards. When I went back to live, I said, I am here. Do you remember me? Yes, we do. I said, now, this is what I want you to do. Now, this is Geraldine talking to these Zulus, and not to Zulus, to Afrikaners. And the I said, I want to work with a group of African children in Soweto to help them find out that there is another side of life other than the ghetto of Soweto. If you have put them in, I mean, I was really tough on them. And I said, so I need your resources and I need money to do this. And so the group that I worked with was my Sunday school group from the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Soweto. And so these white people provided what I asked for to do what I wanted to do with those children and their parents. And that was very significant. Now, when I'm asking these Afrikaners to do these things for me and for these African children. Now, after the election, these Afrikaners had to meet us. They were, and when I say top, they were the man who signed the money there was among the group. The head of the.
When you say sign the money.
Okay.
The signature that's on the bill.
Yes. I mean, really. I mean, all of them were top Afrikaner people. Mm-hmm. So it was called the RAND. It is called the RAND, R-A-N-D. And that's for the RAND of gold that's underneath. That's how
The RAND Corporation.
The RAND, yes. So they invited me on this safari. Well, I had been on safari in Kenya. And so, you know, okay, I hadn't been in the South. Okay, let me try that. But they sent these planes in to fly us to the lodge. And I have pictures of us at the planes and pictures of us at the lodge. And the deal is this. When I got there, I found that I was the only non-South African there. Mm. They had the Afrikaners, of course, who were the white people who had taken the black people's land, mm-hmm. platinum, gold, diamonds, and they lived very well. And then you had the Africans whom they had to invite so that they could begin to talk, who had been just elected to Parliament. And there were two who had money, like the man who owned the grocery stores and the man who owned the petrol stations, the service stations in Soweto. They had, and the man who ran BMW, which was the car to have. They actually killed people for BMW. So there was the Afrikaners and there were these Africans, and then you had Geraldine Williams.
Represent.
Had nothing to do with anything either way, on either side. And I looked at that and tried to figure out, why am I here? Because these people had never talked. They hated each other. But Mandela and his administration said they had to come together for the continuation of the unity of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really the buffer between. So the Africans were talking to me, explaining things about their culture, and the Afrikaners were talking to me, explaining things about their culture. So I was the focal point, and it wasn't one against the other with them. Both of them were looking at me as the outsider, and neither of them was the outsider to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So it was truly a significant contribution to what had to take place there in South Africa. Another thing that I did was to write for Ebony, South Africa, and that's the magazine that we're all familiar with. But they set up over there, and in doing so, as a journalist, I actually helped to capture the history of that transition from apartheid to democracy and the transition from slavery to emancipation.
Mm.
And I felt very good about that. Now, in going to get that, to negotiate for the position with Ebony, I had my son with me, and he went over to, he wasn't with me while I was, negotiating. He went to where the pretty girls were, and they had all these queens, the queen of this, they were pretty girls. Okay. Well, one of them actually called him, and he spoke with her, and she came over to visit. They spent time together. Then she invited him to visit with her, and he told me about it much later, okay? And when he went to visit with her, he noticed that it was in a very elite section of Johannesburg, actually. It was the most elite section of Johannesburg. And everybody has gates and walls and so he noticed that where he was going, it not only had the gates and the walls, it had a security check. He went to the security shack, he went through, and he parked, and she received him in the household, and they were going to have, I guess, aperitifs before they went out for dinner, and he heard these descending steps on a stairwell, and the person who came through was Nelson Mandela.
Oh.
And so Walter was totally shocked. He said, "Mom, I tried not to embarrass you, and so that I wouldn't have."
I tried so hard.
I wouldn't have anything wet on my pants. But I see when the president walked through the door, and of course the president, she said she thought that Walter was aware. He said, "I didn't even know to ask that. I didn't know anything."
But no idea.
That is the nucleus of the relationship that got me invited to spend time with President Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
So when Christmas came, I was invited to spend Christmas. But I had already decided that Walter and I were going to go to Table Mountain, and we were going to climb Table Mountain and carry our backpacks. And when the sun was juxtaposition with the moon, we were going to salute life and all that. I had that going, right? And so I declined the invitation to spend Christmas with the president. And I was in hospital when I got the invitation. And, you know, I told you last week, I'm very religious, okay? And so Jesus was so taken aback by what I did. He went to his Father God and said, I need some help with this Geraldine with a J down here. He declined an invitation from the president of the country to spend Christmas holidays. And so God came in and told me that he was going to handle it and to follow his lead. And, of course, I'm going to do that. And so what happened is it's so hot, it's very hot in South Africa at Christmas time. And Table Mountain just happened to have enough debris that because of the heat, there was spontaneous combustion. And so there was, the man didn't start this. I'm saying that God intervened so that I could have this experience. And so when the spontaneous combustion occurred on top of Table Mountain, I got another call from the Mandela household. Well, do you know what happened? Yes, I do. The invitation is still open. Would you consider coming? And I hesitated. Now, you know, I got God in one ear and Jesus in the other one, like, what are you doing? We told you what to do. And I said, but you knew what I was going to do when you told me that. I'm just saying, if they're qualified, yes, what does that mean? I said, well, I didn't come here. I mean, I'm not a very passive person. I said, what would I do for 3 or 4 days at the president's residence? Just kind of sit around? And I don't think so. Now, this is what I want to do. They said, what is that? And I said, I would like to surprise the president. And so for Christmas, instead of just having, you know, them serve me, let me serve what I'd like to serve for those who are coming inside, because the whole village came up outside. So I didn't go outside and do anything, not much. But I did handle everything for inside. So I went, she told me, do whatever you want to do, and this is his granddaughter. Whatever you want to do, send whatever you want to send, and he will repay you. I said, no. He can't repay me if I'm going to surprise you. She said, he'll repay you after. And I was glad because I didn't have a job. So I spent all of my money putting together, I mean, all kinds of gifts and foods. And I had just entertained the governor of the state of Florida. I had invited a Governor Childs to come over. And one of my law school classmates saw to it that he did come over. And when he came, I had this English couple to prepare a turkey. That's where they took a turkey and stuffed it with chicken and then grilled it grilled the turkey and the chicken. So this is what they did for President Mandela also. And so I did the interior decorating. And when we got there, it was the night of Christmas Eve. And the president was asleep. So we had to be very, when we finally got in, Pastor God, we had to be very careful. But Walter, the president's granddaughter, and the security guard who wasn't going to let us in, they did the decorating outside like we do here in America. They weren't doing that in South Africa. And remember, this is his second Christmas as president. So, you know, he lived better than everybody in the village. And they could all look up. And I had worked it out. So she had told me how it was designed, the driveway and all. So I had lights for them to decorate outside. I decorated inside. And when he awoke to go for his 3 a.m. walk through the mountains, we hid. But he had to walk through those decorative lights. And so the next day, which was Christmas, I had everything in place. I mean, perfectly done. I had gone out to see what the village people were doing. And I was greeted by this white guy who introduced himself. He said, you must be Jerry. I said, I am Steve. And he said, Coca-Cola, because I had asked Coca-Cola to bring the largest tent with as many chairs as they could send and the biggest TV screen with video. And this is for the children in the village because he didn't have anything to do. So, and then he said, Coca-Cola sent everything you asked for. And I said, I want Coca-Cola, all Coca-Cola products. And they did. And he said, but they also sent ice cream sandwiches. And they sent me. And he was a clown. So he was entertaining the children. So when I went back in to check, now listen, this is it. I went back in to check on everything to make sure that by the time the president would awake, everything would be in place. I had decorated the front door, the foyer. I had the biggest Christmas tree in the country at the sit down by his security people, and they didn't tell the president either. Everybody was on lockdown. And so I was standing there trying to decide whether to go to the right or the left or go on the other side of this wall. And when I was about to go to the right, because that was going through the foyer and I could see the Christmas and all of that, the president appeared. And he disappeared. He appeared. I didn't hear a thing. And I understood how my son felt. I had thought that somebody like Walter or the president's granddaughter or security or the household staff, somebody would have introduced me to President Nelson Mandela. And so his granddaughter, I had heard them talking, and she saw this. I was curious what they were referring to him as. And she came over and she explained that we call him Madiba.
Yeah.
Madiba is the name of his clan. And in honor of him, they have named him Madiba. And you must call him Madiba too. I said, listen, honey, that's like asking me to call President Clinton Bill or call President Carter Jimmy. And I'm not doing it. I'm not a member of the Klan. I'm not a member of the band. I'm going to call Madiba. So I had decided I wasn't going to do it, right? When he just appeared and I lost consciousness, I was standing and lost consciousness, and the man must have seen it. Now, can you imagine that I could not talk? He said, you must be Jerry. And I'm like, OMG. Now, I knew I could have thought about him. I had studied. I knew everything. And I said, okay, so she had to tell him that I was coming. I was the only one he did not know. He knew all the people in the village, and he knew Walter. No one knew me. And so I finally was able to speak. I had to pray, and I said, God, listen, I'm going to open my mouth, and you speak for me now, okay? We don't work this. And so when I opened my mouth, I said, oh, Merry Christmas, Madiba. Can you believe it?
You got it right.
Yeah, I actually went there. And so I got my courage up. The Lord was working with me. I got my courage up, and then I carried him on a tour of his house. And I had the fragrance on where you could smell the apple and the cinnamon mixed together. Oh, it was on. And he said, you know, I awoke for my walk, and it had been storming for a week. And he looked out to see what the weather was like. And he said, when I looked out, I saw these twinkling, multicolored lights. And I said, well, what elves came to do this? And he said, listen, after I showed him everything, he said, you have made this the merriest Christmas I have ever had. And I said, oh, wow. That was fine with me, because I wanted to do something for him who had given so much to the world. And I think I had actually achieved that. So that's how I actually met Nelson Mandela. There was nobody else in that house but the two of us, and I know I fainted standing up. I just, you know, I was there, but I couldn't function. And it was the kind of experience that I will never have again.
Yeah. That was something. That was definitely something.
After we had our introduction, and I told him about the gift that I bought him from me and Walter was a children's book, a children's Bible that had the story of Christmas in it. And I told him, because he had everything, anything he couldn't even think of, he had. And so I told him that I know he had this grandson, and that since we were celebrating Christmas, he might want to read to him sometime about the story of Christmas. So that's what I gave him that was probably different from what anybody else would have given him for Christmas. So I went out with him. We went out back where everybody, because he, of course, he's on this estate that has had this wall around it. The men had come in from working at the mines, and they were in these separate rooms, and so I didn't go over there. And they were drinking and they were playing games. But we went past that and went on out. And the first group that he approached and that he dealt with was the group of children. And so I went with him. Now, I'm the journalist, but I did not have a recorder, and I did not write anything because I didn't want to interrupt his flow of being detached from that kind of thing. So I memorized everything, and then I debriefed with Walter after every evening. When we went over to the children, the president liked to dance. And the children were playing Western music, dance music. And they were just dancing, and then they beckoned to him to dance. Now, we all knew Nelson. They knew Madiba. But there was there's two personalities. There was another personality that was sitting there. And I may be the only person, period, who had ever seen that person revealed. And Walter had to help me with pronunciation of that person. It was Roshila, I believe.
Roshila.
Okay, that was the president's name that was given at birth. Now, when he saw these children, I'm watching everything. They were dancing, and they were beckoning him to come to them. It was like they were sirens on the sea, and they were saying, "Come, come." And he was smiling, and he just loved it. Now, I was the only other adult who was around, because everybody else was eating and preparing, and I'm over there following him. And I was watching this, and it was like he was going through a time machine. And he was backpedaling through that time machine to a time way, way down. Because I think at this time he might have been 77 years old. And so he was going through all those years and all those experiences. And he was going back to a time when he had been brought to that village by his mom with his siblings after the death of their father. Mm-hmm. And then he had been adopted by the chief of that village. And so he went to school because, of course, he would send his child to school. He went with the man's natural children. And he then was going back to being where those children were at that time. He was going back to childhood. So I write in the book how he just allowed them to free him, to reduce himself to that level, away from President, away from Nelson, away from Madiba, and down to that child that he was and that they were. It was a beautiful experience. So I write about the fact that I saw him dancing with those children and how they turned to me, and then they said, "You come," and I'm like, I was trying to blend into the wall. they wouldn't let me. It was like, okay, now I don't have a problem dancing, okay? And so I talk about how I started dancing in 1952 when I was in second grade, and I didn't know how to do Charleston, and that's what I had to do out at the late eight play. And so my teacher said to tell my mom to teach me over the weekend how to dance the Charleston, and I've been dancing ever since. So I was able to just go right in with them, and I was very careful. But they loved it that I could do that. But I refer to the fact that I was dancing with the president there. But in Malawi, when I was a guest of the president, I danced for the president. Now there, I had gone as a guest for their 25th anniversary of their university, and the entire stadium was filled with over 60,000 people, and there were at least that many people who were performing for the president who had come from the university. I was among the guests of the president, but in each quadrant of Malawi, they had what they had called the Bumba, B-U-M-B-A, and these were women who danced for the president. And so for this event, the women from the different quadrants of the country out on the field, and they all had on the same pattern of cloth that they were wrapped in, but it would be a different color. One group might have been green, one blue, one gold, one red. And so these were the women from the university, and they were inviting me in my pale pink and silver to go out and dance with them, and I was like, you know, go somewhere else because I'm not doing it. And they kept inviting me every time when we were going. So finally, I stood up. And so my escort said, are you going to the ladies' room? I said, no. And he said, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going with them. He said, what does that mean? I said, I'm going down on the field with them. So I did it. So the lady who was behind me would tell me that when we were going to change from the lead of one foot to the lead of another foot, and she said, just follow. Now, I'll tell you when, and then you follow the lead of the lady in front of you. And I did. When I walked out on that stadium, in that stadium, before, oh, you know, I guess it was with everybody. It might have been about 85,000 people. The place went wild because everybody else was in their costume except me, and I'm in this pale pink and silver. And
and to be honest, let me just put it where it was.
Right.
So the celebration mm-hmm. was really in your honor.
Oh.
Okay. Truth be known.
The unauthorized. Truth be known. That's what happened, and it was incredible. All those people, and because of the work that that my father had done there, and that she had endured things. You know, allowing him to be there to help the country and the things that she had done to help as well. It was incredible, man. The amount of thanks, if you want to call it that, I guess, right? The amount of gratitude, yeah.
It sounded like, from what I've heard in the last half hour, that your mother may have headed off the white Afrikaners' attempt to play divide and conquer in that election.
Absolutely. Well, look, we have calls.
I have a role to play in it.
There's plenty more. There's another call. Let's get these calls quickly. 30 seconds, folks. I'm sorry. We just had to hear this. But 30 seconds, please go directly to your question.
And Geraldine Williams can hear you. Go ahead.
Hey.
Go ahead. It's you, caller.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hey, Walter. This is Jarvis out of Wesley Chapel. Thanks for giving me this time.
All right.
Was that your mother on the phone?
That's my mother, yes.
She's still there.
Is she still on? Can she hear me?
Yes.
Ma'am, I wanted to ask you, and could you tell the people out here, were you ever scared from being a woman around all those black men? I just, you know, because sometimes in America, we're almost scared to talk and interact with each other, you know, because of the history. And I just wanted to know how you felt being around all those black men, and I don't know if there was cops and everything around and all that, but just how did you feel out there? You know what I'm trying to ask, Walter?
Yeah,
how
I'm
feeling being a woman.
I hear you.
Thank
and I'm going to listen to my answer.
Okay, man. Thank you very much.
I was careful. I was there, and I was alone. I was living after Walter came back to the United States to finish at Florida A&M. I was living alone, but I was very careful. And as I said, I prayed, and I listened to the guidance of the spirit that led me. Now, I had to be careful not only of the Africans, but I also of the whites. Let me tell you what happened. I would travel with the IBM Travel Club, and I went to Namibia. And I love deep sea fishing. So what do you do when you go off? You decide what you're going to do. I decided to sign up to go deep sea fishing. I went on the bus that came by to pick us up, and when I got there, I was the only woman and the only person of African descent.
We have a few seconds left, Mom. We got to cut it short.
Huh?
We have to cut it short.
Go ahead. So I did have to be protective of my interests. among the Africans and the Anglos. So I did. I was careful.
Right. Listen, we can't even get to the last call.
No, we're almost
to the last call. So listen, Ma, I want to thank you. Thank you for coming on to the show. This is the Sunday Forum. Our guest has been Attorney Geraldine Williams. And ma'am.
The Talk by GeraldineWilliams.com.
Mm-hmm.
That is my website that is up now. The Talk by GeraldineWilliams.com. And Geraldine is with a J, not a G.
All right.
The Talk by GeraldineWilliams.com. I just wanted to be able to say that.
All right. All right. Hey, thank you for joining us, Attorney Geraldine Williams, Mom. Thank you for joining us, everybody out there who called in. And please, make sure to have a great, great, and safe Sunday. And as always, from my voice to the radio waves, to the hearts and the minds of the people, we love you. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about it here on the Sunday Forum.
WMNF Tampa, stay tuned for the Postmodern Hootenanny coming your way next.